God, what are you doing? Are you doing anything? Where are you when I need you? When we need you? People ask those kind of questions quite often. Not usually when things are going really well, but when things go bad, these sort of questions start to arise. Indeed, even people who don't call themselves Christians or people who are critics of Christianity often ask those sort of questions. On Easter Sunday, I mentioned one of my favorite bands, Pearl Jam, have a song that came out last year, and I mentioned that song. They also have another song that came out last year on the same album, and this other song is called Mind Your Manners. And in that song, the singer Eddie Vedder asks a really interesting question. Says something really interesting. He says, I caught myself believing that I needed God, and if it's out there somewhere, we sure could use him now. Bit of wordplay. He's obviously pretty skeptical about whether any sort of God might be out there, but this it, he says, if it's there, then now's the time for God to turn up. Because the reasons he gives come shortly after. This world's a long love letter that makes me want to cry. You see the point. The world's beautiful, but it is messed up. And if God's there, says Eddie Vedder, it's about time he showed up and did something. I've got a friend who's more aggressively atheistic than Eddie Vedder. Eddie Vedder's actually fairly mild. My friend's a bit more rah. And I remember him putting a message on his Facebook wall on the internet. And basically, he named all kinds of gods, Yahweh, Zeus, Thor, a bunch of others. And he said, if you're out there, then now would be a good time to turn up and do something. He said that because there was a number of world events going on at that time where there was a lot of pain and a lot of injustice and a lot of suffering happening. He doesn't believe in God, partly, he says, because if God is out there, why doesn't he do something? But Christians often ask the same sorts of questions as well. When things are really hard, we ask, God, what are you doing? Even if we don't ask it out loud, we ask it in our heart of hearts. And if you've gone through something really hard as a Christian, or if you've seen someone close to you go through something really hard, something that really hurts, seems to have no way out, then that question that you ask is often precisely, God, what are you doing? It's a question that was almost certainly being asked by the Israelite people who are in slavery in Egypt, which we heard in our Exodus reading, which was page 55 and 56 of those Bibles. It would be great if, as David said, you could have that open. As we saw last week, the Israelites were under oppressive slavery from a king, the Pharaoh, and the king was feeling threatened by them, so he really oppressed them. And it had gotten to the point that this king had ordered the killing of the baby boys born to the Israelites. It's almost impossible, I think, to get our heads into the fear and hurt that and the horror that they were living under at that time. Even if this order wasn't uniformly carried out, which it seems it probably wasn't, there was always still the danger that at any point your baby son or your baby nephew or your baby cousin might be taken away and thrown in the river. At any time, you always knew that could happen in an hour's time or tomorrow or next week. You'd be living in this constant fear, anxiety that this could happen. Surely they were asking, God, what are you doing? After all, they were the people that God had chosen, and he'd made promises to their ancestors, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all those. So what was God doing? Had he forgotten his promises? Was he not seeing what had happened? What was happening in Egypt? God, what are you doing? It's in the midst of this scene of horror that the Exodus story zooms in chapter 2 on a couple who have a baby boy. And here we see the beginning of a rescue. verses 1 to 2. Have a look with me. Now a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. So this couple, they have a child, and the mum knows there's something special about this child, and so she hides him. But eventually, verse 3, she knows that it's not going to work anymore. The hiding isn't going to work. The boy's going to be found. Can you imagine her desperation at this point? This is her baby boy. She loves him, but she has to do something, or else his fate is sealed if she doesn't act. What will she do? That kind of horrible situation is the kind of thing we don't like to think about. But this woman had no choice. She had to do something. So verse 3, she gets a basket. She coats it to make it as waterproof as she can. And just feel what she does next. Just feel this. Here's the basket. She takes her baby boy, puts him in the basket, shuts the lid, takes the basket, puts it on the river. She avoids the pain of having him thrown into the river by putting him on the river in the hope, the desperate hope, that something else might happen. Verse 4, the baby's big sister stands at a distance to watch, to see what might happen to this precious, desperate little boat. God, what are you doing when a mother has to do that? Has to put her baby in a little basket on a river to avoid the baby being thrown into the river. Verse 5, Pharaoh's daughter heads down to the Nile with her attendants to bathe. And if we know this story, we might at this point feel relief. There she is. But I remember one of my teachers at college, he said he was reading this to his children. And when it said Pharaoh's daughter came down to the Nile, they went, in fear. And they were right, because this is Pharaoh's daughter. This is the daughter of the man who'd ordered the killing of the babies. She's going down to the river. This is not a safe thing. In verse 5, she catches sight of the basket in the reeds, and she sends one of her servants to go and get it. And as she opens the lid of the basket, she finds a baby boy, and he's crying. But she feels compassion for him. She knows who he is. Verse 6, she says, this is one of the Hebrew babies. But she has mercy on him. And so we have here a rescue. This baby boy is not going to be drowned. This one at least will be saved. In fact, this baby boy is really saved, really rescued. Verse 7, his sister's right there to ask very sharply if Pharaoh's daughter just maybe might like her to find a Hebrew woman to nurse the baby perhaps. There's an idea. So, shall I find a Hebrew woman to be your wet nurse, maybe? Just thought of it. In the end, Pharaoh's daughter thinks that's not only a good idea, but she thinks she'll pay the Hebrew woman to nurse this baby. So the baby's rescued, returns to his mother, and the mother gets paid to look after him. You see what's happening here? This isn't just a rescue. This is an over-rescue, a rescue plus, a rescue and much, much more. It's an over-rescue to an ironic degree because the baby's saved by the daughter of the one who's trying to kill him and then ends up becoming part of the royal family in Pharaoh's house. And all the while, his own mother, having been desperate, now is paid to raise him. Even the baby's name in verse 10, which is a name with Egyptian roots, it has a meaning in Hebrew which has to do with rescue. So there's kind of a double meaning thing going on there. I drew him out of the water. I drew him out. This is a picture of the rescue that God's going to bring. God's never actually mentioned in this little bit of the story, but he is there, working away, bringing about a rescue. And over the top rescue, actually, that points to a much greater rescue which is coming, where a whole people will be drawn out of danger. And that too will be an over the top rescue, where they end up with more than they could have imagined. But we won't ruin all of that. We'll leave that for future weeks. For now, we can see this is the beginning of a rescue. Beginning of a rescue. Now, in verses 11 to 12, we see the beginning of a rescuer. Beginning of a rescuer. See, after a while, Moses grows up, as baby boys tend to do. In verse 11, he goes out where his own people, the Hebrews, were working. He seems to know his heritage. Perhaps his birth mother began teaching it to him when he was very small, or she'd seen him since. Perhaps those in the palace knew the amazing story of his rescue. Whatever the case, he knows his heritage. He goes out to see his people, and he sees them laboring. And he sees them mistreated. In fact, he sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. And verse 12, glancing this way and that, seeing that no one's there, he killed the Egyptian, and he hid him in the sand. So here we're seeing the beginning of a rescuer. Moses obviously sees himself as a rescuer. He identifies with his people and their oppression and his slavery. He rails against the violence that's being used against them. He wants to save them. And yet, he's not a very impressive rescuer, is he? He glances this way and that, sneakily, like a kid, maybe my kid, but I couldn't comment, who is going to hit his brother or sister and looks to see if mum and dad are looking. No, ha ha, right. It's not very impressive, is it? Up to this point, Moses has seemed impressive, I think. He's been presented as a fine child. In fact, that whole birth story that we read, verses 1 to 10, and how he was saved, it's told in a similar way to a lot of the stories of the birth of ancient kings. So Moses is being presented to us as a great leader until he gets sneaky on us and kills a man when no one's looking. Moses is a very mixed, flawed character. And people know it. As he goes out, verses 13 to 14, he sees two of his own people fighting each other, which frustrates him because he just tried to save them from that. He asks what on earth they're doing. And the one in the wrong, in a classic piece of defensiveness, says, "Who made you ruler and judge?" It's kind of like, you know, who made you the boss of me? It's not a very sensible response, except that it shows Moses has lost his integrity, because the man knows that he's killed the Egyptian. Moses tried to be sneaky, but he wasn't sneaky enough. The word's gotten out. And he has to run for his life to a faraway place. And now this rescuer, with so much potential, is a fugitive and an alien in a strange land. He's gone from a rescuer to a fugitive. Even though, as a fugitive, he still kind of hints that he's a rescuer. So verses 16 to 17, he quite gallantly actually rescues a group of sisters whom some shepherds are harassing and trying to take advantage of them. And Moses, look at verse 17, halfway through, Moses got up and came to their rescue. Came to their rescue. And he watered their flock. See, he's still a rescuer in a way. And yet, even when he marries one of these girls that he rescues and he settles down and he has a baby, the name of the son that he has gives away the real situation. So verse 22, have a look. Moses named his son Gershom, saying, "I have become an alien in a foreign land." See, in the end, this rescuer is far away. He's flawed and out of place. He has, in a sense, been unrescued. He's been driven far away from his people, and he's been put in no position to do anything to help. Remember, he was rescued from the river as a baby, and he had all this potential. He was put into a place in the palace where maybe he could have done something to help his people. He could have influenced the Pharaoh. But now, through his own failings, he's ended up far away, unrescued, in no position to be of any help whatsoever. Some beginning to the rescuer. So, what is God doing? His people are still in the same desperate position now that they were at the start, before any of this happened. Look at the start of verse 23. During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and they cried out. They're still under the hand of Pharaoh, their oppressor. Their babies, baby boys presumably, are still being thrown into the Nile. And this rescuer, who seemed to have so much promise, has failed and he's far away from bringing any help. God, what are you doing? Well, if we keep reading verse 23, we get a glimpse of what God is doing. The people cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. And here's what God's doing, verse 24. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. God was doing four things there. Just before we see what those four things are, I want to show you how strongly these couple of verses make this point. In the NIV, the translation we use, which is very good, it's a very good translation, just in this point, it masks this just a little bit for the sake of smoothness and easiness to read. But in the original, it actually says the name of God four times in that one little bit. So literally it says, God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites, and God was concerned about them. Do you get the point? God was doing something. First of all, God was hearing them. They probably thought he wasn't. May not have looked like he was, but he was. He was hearing their cry. He was not ignoring them. He was hearing them. Secondly, God remembered. He had made promises to their ancestors, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He had not forgotten those promises. He was remembering their promises at that very moment, and he was going to do something about it. Third, God looked on the Israelites. He knew exactly what was going on. He was watching. He saw all of it. Every beating, every baby thrown into the river, God saw it. It had not escaped his notice. And finally, God was concerned. Literally, it says God knew. He knew what was happening. It hadn't escaped him. He knew it. He knew what it meant. He was concerned about it. He cared about his people, and he knew what he was going to do about it. So what is God doing? He was hearing them. He was remembering his commitment to them. He was seeing what was happening to them. And he was caring about it. Because this is the God who is just like this. This is what God is like. He is the saving one. The saving one who saves and cares about his people. Across the story of Exodus, we're going to be looking at the saving one. The one who saves. And all the way through this little story in chapter 2, where it seemed like God might not have been there, the saving one was actually working. He was working to save a baby who would end up being his instrument to save a whole people. And not only did he save that baby, remember, he over-saved him. He over-rescued that baby. He overdid it in his saving goodness. And he used his enemies to do it. Pharaoh's very own daughter became the key to saving the one who he was going to use to save his whole people. This is what God's like. He is an over-saving God. He was working through the flaws and weaknesses of this new rescuer, Moses. in all Moses' sneakiness and his weakness, and even when Moses ran away and was far away, actually the saving one was at work, because soon, precisely in this faraway place, God's going to reveal himself to Moses. And Moses then is going to be called back to Egypt to lead his people out of Egypt into this other land in the wilderness, which Moses already understood because he'd lived there. The saving one was at work. The saving one was always at work. And he never stopped hearing, remembering, looking, or caring for his people, no matter what it might have seemed like. And when we ask in our heart of hearts, whether we do out loud or not, when we ask in our heart of hearts, God, what are you doing? When we face having a sick family, the death of a loved one, the loss of a child even, the breakdown of relationships, opposition to the gospel in society or in our church, as we face changes that we don't like in our culture or in our life, as we face temptations that just won't go away, frustrations that keep coming back, weaknesses we wish we could get rid of, disappointments we don't want to have to deal with, as we face getting older and feeling like our heyday is past, or we face being restricted by our health or our circumstances, as we face these very real things in life, we ask God, what are you doing? And the answer is, even in those hard times, God is being God. He is being who he is, the saving one. And he has shown himself even more to us as the saving one, in that he's come and experienced our hardships, our pains in Jesus, and he saved us eternally. So we too have this saving one. This same God from Exodus has revealed himself even more clearly to us as the saving one. We have the saving one who hears us whenever we cry out to him. Have you cried to him? He has heard you. We have the saving one who has not forgotten and will never forget his promises to save us and bless us in Christ forever. We have the saving one who sees the situations that we're in and sees them even more deeply than we do, and the details even more starkly than we do. And we have the saving one who knows and cares. He knows what our situation is like. He knows through Jesus what it's like to face temptation, oppression, disappointment, loss, pain. He knows that intimately, and yet, as well as knowing that, he knows exactly how he can use our situation for our ultimate good and for the good of his kingdom. That is our God. That is our saving one. That is our rescuer. And that is what he is doing. That's what he is doing. That's what he's like. That's who we call on. So may he help us to remember who it is that is our God, to continue calling on him no matter what. Let me pray. Gracious Lord, our saving one, help us to remember you when things are hard, and for those for whom things are hard right now, help us to see that you hear, you remember, you see, and you know and you care. Thank you for being our saving one. Through Christ our Lord. Amen.